What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Today I'm talking to Samira Ahmed, multi-award-winning journalist, writer and broadcaster, mainly these days at the BBC, where she presents Front Row on Radio 4 and Newswatch on the BBC News Channel. She also presents the popular podcast How I Found My Voice and is a regular columnist for New Humanist. On a personal note, she's also my very favourite of BBC Religion presenters, which is where we first met when she was presenting Sunday Morning Live. Samira Ahmed, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Thank you for having me.
I'm feeling a lot of pressure here because, of course, one of the things that you're best known for is asking questions and being and being a very accomplished and erudite and effective interviewer. And now this is the other way around. And so I'm in a hot seat in a sense, even though you are as well. I thought we might start with that, though, because this is a podcast about, you know, your motivations, your beliefs, your values, what takes you into the things that you do and why. Why do you think it is that you've ended up being motivated to be such a questioner?
Oh, that's such a good question, actually. I just think from a young age, I've always just noticed when something isn't right. And I've never assumed that just because other people are going along with it, I should too. I've just never been that person. And So a really trivial example is in the swimming pool yesterday, I arrived, and this is the outdoor pool at my gym, and half the pool cover was in the pool. So like a third of the pool you couldn't get to because it was, and so I just thought, right, well, we just have to pull this flipping cover off because it's somehow blown in the wind. And there was and of course all the swimmers going up and down, and one of the men said, oh, if anyone can fix this, it's you, because they know me. And I said, well, if you all help. And of course I got some of the guys to get out the pool, give me a hand, and we pulled it out. So I'm one of those people who, if I see something's wrong, I'll challenge it. And whether that was in school where I was accused of something I didn't do, and I tried to make my case to the headmistress. I really, she just wasn't interested in hearing the truth. And I just thought, well, you're wrong and I'm right. From then on, I've just always known that I ask questions and I don't. The way I put it is, we need to challenge the official version of things more. And that's what got me through life rather well, including on things like challenging the official version of pay.
Yeah, well, that's right. We'll come to that, I'm sure. So you're worrying away at something. You're trying to get to the root of it, trying to get to the truth of it. Is that what you're doing when you're
questioning?
It's
all about truth, yeah. And it's also about not assuming that because someone's got seniority and is in a position of authority that they're necessarily right or truthful. And, you know, as I say, once you worked out as a child that adults can lie or be deceitful or actually be quite incompetent, then that never leaves you. So, and then of course there are lots of lovely people out there too, but I'm unafraid. I'm unafraid to challenge people in positions of power who I think are lying or, you know, not up to it. And I just think they should be challenged.
Are you generally suspicious of them? Are you suspicious of people in power?
I judge people by their actions. So if something seems to be wrong, then they need to explain to me why it's not. And right now, with everything that's going on in British politics in particular, there's a lot of things that it's legitimate to question and challenge. But, you know, you pick your battles too, Andrew. I don't fight with everyone.
No, exactly.
And also part of it is, as you know, I'm going to say it now because it will come out at some point in conversation. You know, I think like a lot of people, like a lot of women, like a lot of people of colour, and dare I say it, as an older woman as well, I'm just used to always being underestimated, patronised, assumptions made about me. And so I often give the analogy of one of my favourite role models is Wonder Woman. And the interesting thing about Wonder Woman, if you read the original comics, is her alter ego is Diana Prince, who is a very smart woman who works either at the UN or works in military intelligence. And her secret power is being just the woman in the room and being underestimated and listening and observing. And I guess that's how I operate. That's how a lot of us operate.
Has that helped you be? Yeah, I was going to say you try to use it. I mean, that's helps you be an effective questioner. Do you sometimes play with the sort of ingenue? I think I've seen you maybe sometimes deploy a bit of a depth charge, especially with older men when you're interviewing them. There's sort of like an unexpected, not quite Miss Marple, that's not quite right, but a sort of like almost innocent question that really then unmasks them and gets right to the heart of something. Are you using that being underestimated actively?
Yes. I mean, obviously, I would rather not be underestimated.
Quite.
But sometimes, you know, you judge people. You can tell by, you know, their age, their background. You can guess how they might be viewing you. You know, as a woman, you're always used to thinking about the male gaze. And as a journalist, I always think about what assumptions are people making about me when I walk into the room. And if they'd never met me, that was one of the great things. That's one of the things I said about when I applied for Question Time. I said, the great thing about me is, in a way, they all know who I am, but they don't necessarily all know how I operate. And that was what I thought was very good about my time at Channel 4 News was, you know, because some politicians didn't necessarily know me, I was absolutely able to be very effective. But you start from the point of view that you listen and you give them respectful time. It isn't about trying to undermine people. It's not about, crucially, my interviewing is not about trying to make people look bad for the sake of it, you know, like a gotcha. That's not what my interviewing is about. It's about getting to the truth.
And you're uncovering something.
Yeah, and also the single most important thing is on behalf of the audience, who are usually licensed fee payers. It's for them. They're smart and they deserve the truth. It's not about my ego.
Is that a sense of public service, or is that a sense of solidarity, or is it a sense of service? What do you think motivates that last bit you said? Because that's something on top of this questioning. That's something else, isn't it?
So the idea of public service and public service broadcaster is very important. I was raised to believe in BBC values, and I've met many wonderful people over my life since childhood who worked at the BBC. And I think I like to think there are the people who represent the best of the BBC. It's like the people who do great stuff in the NHS. We all know that there are bad people there too. But, you know, think about what that BBC public service ethos is at its best. That's what I serve. That's why I was talking to someone the other day. I said, you know, if I were to apply to be director general, one of my big things would be maximum salary cap, probably a quarter of a million. You know, people shouldn't be in public service if they don't want to be in public service. It is a privilege to work here. You can be paid well, you know, and these days people can do other stuff outside if they want. But, you know, you're not here to earn a rock star salary. So that's that. But I think solidarity was an interesting word because, you know, I do believe in the importance of equality and sticking together. And of course, in a literal sense, as a member of a union, that changed my life.
Right.
So, and I mean, whenever I go and speak in schools, like I'm going to give another careers talk at my daughter's old school in a couple of weeks. And I said, you know, I want to give a talk rather than sit at a desk and people come and talk to me about journalism, because I want to talk to you about the stuff that no one tells you, which is join a union, how to ask about pay early on, because if they get you on the female track, you'll never make it up. You know, that importance of male colleagues being allies and sharing pay information. And that's the way that we negotiate our lives, whatever career you go into. So that's what comes from a sense of solidarity and passing on lessons. And, you know, gratitude for those who taught me these things themselves when I was young.
You definitely see yourself as a woman in this social sense. You're part of a community of other women, and you're working on behalf of other women, aren't you? That sense is very strong in what you've said so far. You feel yourself as part of that cohort.
Well, I'm a feminist.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, I don't know if you've seen Sylvia, this new amazing hip hop musical at the Young
Adult. I haven't. I'm desperate to see it.
Sylvia Pankhurst. So one of the really interesting things in it, which I think really resonates, is Sylvia was socialist. And when it became apparent that her mother, Emmeline, and the feminist, the sort of suffragette movement was kind of moving towards, well, let's just get votes for nice middle class women like us. And she said, "That's not enough. We've got to get votes for working class men and working class women. And it isn't acceptable to talk about women's suffrage without talking about all women." And that's the kind of solidarity based feminism, which I think is has the longest tradition in this country. And that's definitely what I'm part of. And it encompasses race as well, of course.
Right. I was going to say, is it liberation generally? Or are you, yeah, it's not just women, it's every person? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's this idea of women's liberation is important. In fact, it was something I was reading Julie Bindle's book about women's lib. And she said, I mean, she says that controversial. One thing she said was, we don't want equality, we want liberation. And I thought, oh, philosophically, that's such an interesting idea, because I've always gone on about equality, but actually liberation might not be quite the same thing.
So you believe liberation in liberation? You want liberation?
Yeah, I don't know how I'd define it. I mean, I might define it differently to how
that was going to be my next other question. People would.
but equality is fundamental, I think. I don't think I would disagree with anyone about the idea of equality.
No, but it's a minimum. It's a social minimum. There's other things as well, like liberation, for example, which is different. Yeah. It's living. I mean, that's quite typical, isn't it, for lots of campaigns. I mean, I remember when I was at university, the women's group and the LGBT group and the I can't remember what it was exactly called, but because they had quite, so the LGBT group was actually called Queer Rights, and the anti-racism group was called, that was called the anti-racism group. And collectively they were known as the liberation campaigns, right? Because that was how it seemed that was their common brand. And it was exactly as you've just said, liberation might not mean equality. I know for lots of those people, it meant actually unpicking the assumptions of the society that they found themselves in. They didn't want the equality of X or Y. They wanted a different way of living.
This is the most intriguing thing for me. So I spent a lot of time watching and studying the films of John Waters, and I've interviewed him a few times. I'm fascinated by his films, a lot of which are still really, really provocative. And of course, if you look back at some of his early films, they're full of jokes about the idea of heterosexual patriarchal couples and having children. Like, why would you want to ape the patriarchal heterosexual system? Right. That would have been anathema to the kind of the gay liberation movement of the 70s. And you could argue that part of liberation is people make their own choices, in the same way that feminists have said, you know, your choice can be to be a homemaker, you know, what we used to call a housewife. But it is interesting that, you know, the older idea of gay liberation, the last thing anyone thought about was absolutely the right. Like, you didn't want marriage, because marriage was something to be, you know,
liberated from.
Yeah. So in that sense, I'm not saying there's one right answer. I'm just saying it's really interesting that you have, it's almost like what seemed to be a single path, you know, heading in one direction, it fans out into all these different options that people choose different ones on that spectrum of their idea of freedom and liberation.
So you've addressed that as a sort of intellectual point, but what's your own preference? What excites you most, the idea of liberation or the idea of equality?
Liberation is an exciting idea, but it's philosophically complicated.
Yeah.
I think the idea of equality is something I think everyone can get behind.
Right.
You know, it's about people being treated fairly, isn't it? And about being given equal opportunity. It's such an important concept. It doesn't exist in so much of my world, you know, job-wise.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, because you took that equal pay case against the BBC, which was extremely difficult. I remember you going through the difficulties of it. Difficult in so many ways, because first of all, you're facing up to an institution. I mean, that's what the BBC is, isn't it? And whatever else it is, it's a big institution, very powerful, you know, very difficult to confront. But you faced all other sorts of challenges as well, as anyone does taking a case like that. And you got a lot of support, but you also obviously had a lot of difficulties doing it. What kept you motivated through that?
So it was a long time coming. And you know, when you've just been lied to repeatedly and you've given them every opportunity to kind of compromise, find a way out, give me a pay rise, give me a proper pay rise, let's put it behind us. Also, crucially, I'd been through this before elsewhere.
Right.
You know, this wasn't the first time I'd been discriminated against. But it had just got to a ridiculous point where I just thought the pay gap is too big. I can't live with myself by not fighting this. And I was prepared for the possibility that I might lose, but I didn't see how I could, really. And once the union had taken it on and, you know, agreed that it the case had merit. And it was such an unusual case because the pay gap was, you know, seven times my salary.
Yeah, I mean, that
is remarkable. So, yeah, you know, it really was. And, you know, and I'll say it again, to his credit, Jeremy Vine shared his pay information with me. So that made my life a lot easier because then I knew the numbers. I wasn't guessing, which is guessing that there's a big pay gap. And then they have to accept or refuse an offer to settle without knowing what the actual amount is that they could have got. And I wasn't taking the financial risk. So once all that came into it, I just thought, I have to do this. I want everyone to know what's really going on. And if I lose, at least everyone knows the truth. And everyone understands that sometimes you lose despite being in the moral right. But from the moment my barrister, who's just been made a KC, by the way, I'm about to go to her silk party.
Congratulations to her.
I know, Claire Darwin of Beatrix Chambers. the moment she began speaking, one of my friends was sitting next to me in the tribunal, leaned over and whispered in my ear, Samira, you're going to win this. She was amazing. She was formidable. Her and my solicitor, Caroline Thompson, who's a really experienced trades union lawyer, been in that business 30 years. And I remember one day she'd gone through my papers because they had to make the decision. And she just said to me, this is a really shocking case. And I thought, oh, it's not just me thinking that then. You know, someone outside has looked at my papers impartially and just seen loads and loads of things and said, there's something really not right here. So I'm really proud. I'm really proud of being in the union. I'm really proud for my children.
Those things are a group effort, aren't they, as well? Right. Those things, people who take those legal actions, and I know this was true of you, you're doing it for your own sake, but you're also doing it for a broader demographic, in your case, women. And it's also a group effort to make it there. I mean, one of the strongest images of your tribunal was walking there every morning, as you did, surrounded by women and male allies
and
too.
A lot of men single day. It was women and men. It was never.
That was very vivid.
You know, I know. And you know, people of all kinds of backgrounds. And you know, I was so touched. Like Lem Sisse got off a plane from, you know, the Far East and came straight from Heathrow Airport on the tube to walk to tribunal with me. Total strangers who'd heard about my case came along. And I remember some graduate students from Imperial College, and they'd brought their boyfriends, which makes it sound like the boyfriends were coming along unwillingly, that their boyfriends were willing to come, but like the girlfriends told them about it and they came too.
Excellent.
You know, it was that kind of attitude.
Going back to news, are you just reporting the story, or are you, you know, you're going out there and identifying it?
So it's one thing that I've realised, and it does go back to my my literary critical skills, which I learned at university. So English degree, you think it's non-vocational. But, you know, you read the document and then you find what's really going on here. And that might be to do with when it was written, what do we know about the authenticity of this document, all the rest of it. And so what I realised is this is my modus operandi. Show me the data and I will find the story. That whether that's reading a report or it's watching the way someone conducts an interview, you know, I will always work out what's the real story here. And sometimes I spot a story that no one else has. So a really interesting example is Operation Crevice. It was the fertilizer bomb plot trial. And this group of young British Muslim men who were planning to blow up nightclubs in London, and they were storing fertilizer in a storage unit. And basically they got infiltrated by security services. They were filming them and stuff. And one of the defendants, who was a public school educated former LSE student, I think, he did testify in his defense for one day. And on that day, one of the things he was asked about was when 9/11 happened. And he said, when 9/11 happened, I was happy. And all the newspapers ran with, when 9/11 happened, I was happy. Like, this was their headline. But actually, what I spotted was a story in which was what I made the focus of my report for Channel 4 News that night was, he said, when I went to that Kashmiri training camp, you know, terrorist training camp, and his family found out where he'd gone, they went to get him back. But he said, when I came home, I was garlanded with flowers. And there are hundreds of people like me who feel the way I do. And that's when I thought, that's the story, is that's that there were all these British home. And this was years before 7/7. So, you know, I saw the story because I genuinely look and listen and I don't apply biases. I'm open-minded. And I think that partly comes from my background. Like, you know, I understand Islam because I was partly raised in it. So, and I also, you know, I'm partly Pakistani heritage. So I knew exactly what he was talking about.
Right. You mentioned when you're talking about your own motivations and what it was that sort of propelled you into this type of work, desire to uncover the truth, the value of questioning, putting authority under scrutiny, and doing all of that on behalf of the public, at least in the sense of in a public service broadcaster having a sort of a duty to do those things. What do you think of the culture of news in the UK today? Do you think that it's, is it a thing you're happy? Has it got better since you came in? Are those values what it?
No,
I assume that'd be the answer.
Well, we're talking on a Friday afternoon just after I recorded Newswatch, and I interviewed Richard Eyre, not the theatre director, but another Richard Eyre, who used to be a very senior BBC News executive. He left in the early 2000s and went off to places like Ofcom. And, you know, he was saying that one of the good things about them merging the news channels is we're getting more international news now on domestic bulletins. So on one literal level, I have really noticed how BBC News, a lot of other broadcast news in the UK, have become much more domestic than we were. And I can't help thinking in the run-up to the Brexit vote, now, where did we get coverage of what was happening in European politics and European Parliament?
Mm.
Nowhere. And yet we were making a decision about our future in it when we never got coverage of Parliament. And I just feel that the amount of detail we got about public affairs and politics internationally and domestically has kind of really deteriorated. And I think now, this is one of the questions I put to Richard there, is, you know, the BBC to be withdrawing a dedicated news channel at a time when political discourse has never been more toxic and aggressive. It's like, why would you withdraw from that space when the public really need someone who's impartial and calm? You don't need GB News. You don't need that kind of radio talk. You know, I mean, talk radio has its role. I'm not saying these things should be banned. So don't. I'm not saying that. But, you know, what we're losing is the really calm, impartial broadcasting. And instead, we're going to be left with the more partial. I mean, and also we're leaving, you know, Sky News to, you know, which is very good.
Yes.
So absolutely. Be the prime sort of serious broadcaster of rolling news in this country. So I think it's in a bad way. I think political discourse is terrible. I think I've never seen the levels of corruption and, you know, blatant doubling down over things that I see now. It's been going on for some years and it's been gradually corroding. But it's,
and you think
very,
that's enabled by the decline of news?
Yes, we don't know how to challenge. Mm. But also, I think it's also exposed the weakness of our supposedly amazing democratic system where, you know, you have ethics advisors and all these things. The roles are left unfilled, or it turns out they're all connected to people appointing them. I mean, it just, you know, I think it's fair to say we look like, we may not be, but we look like a banana republic compared to what we were 30 or 40 years ago in many ways, I think. I do think other nations look at Britain and what's going on here and think, what has happened to that country that we used to think was a kind of real upholder of law and of, you know, it had a whole system of checks and balances. I think we proved to ourselves maybe the reality that it always relied on a gentleman's agreement. And so it depends on having gentlemen.
Right. You have quite
with
an international...
All that goes with that word.
Exactly. And there's good and bad in that, as we're seeing what possibly might have been the good now that it's gone, I think. Mm. But do you have quite an international perspective, quite a global perspective, and a lot of your work you've applied your questioning to other cultures, both past and today. Do you think that that's one of the things that informs your view of our own culture as well? Because often when you're speaking, it's not quite ethnographic the way you're talking about Britain, but it does have a sense of sort of participant observation, not just participant. You know, are you looking from the outside to some extent quite often?
That's a good question. Well, I think being a journalist, you know, you're always an observer too.
Right.
I like that. I mean, in a way, a journalist is a certain kind of storyteller. I don't write fiction. I just think true stories, real life is so rich and compelling. I love the amazing richness of stories that come out of this country. But also I think having, you know, being the child of immigrants, and I remember growing up in the 70s was a very hostile time in many ways. You know, funnily enough, I was talking to a documentary crew about The Good Life, which was one of my favourite sitcoms. And so, you know, part of growing up and finding your own identity as someone who's British born, which is different to your parents who came as immigrants, is assimilating different ideas and working out where you are. So watching sitcoms was quite an interesting insight into the English way of life. It wasn't like we were sort of trying to ape it exactly, but there were little things in it that, you know, you might absorb, or going to other friends' houses for tea, which is like a very British concept, and absorbing that. And then traveling a lot. I was very lucky. My parents took me Well, we went to India and Pakistan a lot to visit family, but they also traveled around the world. I went to the States for the first time in 1976 at bicentennial year. It was a really exciting time. I fell in love with American culture then, and I've just always been thrilled by it. And then in the early 80s, when there was two things that were really big, like new romantic culture, but also like Japanese culture was really big. I was obsessed with Japan and, you know, so all those things kind of are with you. And I've always kept my enthusiasms. And I think that's also perhaps what I would say is distinctive about the way I look at the world is I'm really genuinely interested in the things I'm interested in. And things that I loved as a kid, I still love. So,
and you've got quite a wide range of interests.
Like, I'm going to be hopefully interviewing Depeche Mode very soon because I saw they got a new album out. And I know that I bought their first single sitting on my shelf in my living room. So, like, you know, it's all connected. And I'll do a professional job, you know, but it comes from a place of genuine passion and enthusiasm. And then learning about things that I didn't know. You know, there's always new stuff to learn. Like, I'm learning about opera. I know a bit about opera, but I'm not an expert on opera. But I'm learning loads about opera these days. I'm going to the opera a lot.
It's very interesting that you've got this sort of inside-outside perspective on everything that you've described. You're sort of looking at it from the outside, and then you're getting into it and being enthusiastic about it, and then you're stepping out and looking at it from the outside again. This is
Well, the thing I tell people, when I was a kid, you know, there was always this fear about, oh, God, you know, you're that, being the Asian girl, that just you worried about races and you worried about, you know, being embarrassed and the way that your parents expected you to dress, wearing Asian clothes and things. And then you get older, you think, actually, I've got two cultures. I've got twice as much as people who were only raised in one.
Right.
So I'm, you know, I've got a huge advantage. And so anyone who comes from a kind of mixed heritage, I think, should see themselves as having this kind of innate advantage. It's like being multilingual, which I was as well, of course, as a result of having parents who come from India and Pakistan. So yeah, that's, but you know, and it's getting kids to realize that about themselves very young, you know, and seeing it as positive. I remember hearing these terrible stories about children in the 70s who, you know, sometimes they came from broken homes, but they were of Asian heritage or Black heritage and wished they were white. You would have these children who would be taken to care who had, you know, real breakdown issues to do with their color. And a lot of it was the racism they were experiencing in schools.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, that level of trauma existed when I was a kid. I was so lucky that I had loving parents who gave me a strong sense of myself. But also, and this I will volunteer, you know, I had to some extent educate my parents and assert myself because my parents, you know, they weren't mean with it, but they definitely were quite conservative. So, you know, I wasn't going to be allowed to have boyfriends. Assumption was I would have an arranged marriage, as he used to say.
No. Is that right?
Yeah.
I would never have thought that of
even though my parents fell in love in London and my mother's Hindu, my father's Muslim, which is hilarious. It was out of concern. They wanted to protect us. They were worried about what it would be like for us in this country. They're worried about us being exploited and all the rest of it. And, and when I was 18 and I went to university, in fact, I was almost 19 and I had my first serious boyfriend. And for a couple of months over the summer holidays, I kept it a secret. And then I just thought, why? Like, why? This is crazy. I'm a grown up. You know, I'm being educated at Oxford University. My parents are so proud of me. It wasn't like they were putting any restrictions on my education or what they wanted to do in my life. Why am I going around hiding? And I hope my brother won't mind me saying this, but he kept his girlfriend secret for many years when he was at school. And I just thought, I can't do this. So I took my mother, because it was my mother who was the one I had to tell. She's the formidable one. And I said, Mum, I want to take you for a drive. And we got in the car and we drove to Richmond Park. And in the car park in Richmond Park, I said, I need to tell you, I've got a boyfriend. This is his name. This is what he does. And I don't think you should be upset about it. And I completely, I took her by such surprise. And I think she was very impressed that I'd handled it in this way. And as a result of that, obviously, my brother no longer. I mean, they knew about my brother's girlfriend by this point, but it was sort of like, it wasn't sort of talked about really. Yeah. And so as a result of what I did, suddenly the whole thing lifted. My sister therefore had no issues when she went to university. I just thought this is not right. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And
do you like being the pioneer? You like being the pioneer.
So I'm a pioneer. I know. But then, on the other hand, I knew my mother wasn't going to throw me out or do any of these terrible things that really repressive religious fundamentalist parents might do. And I have met people who've been through that in my reporting, and my heart goes out to them. So I was lucky because I was an educated girl. My mother couldn't argue with the daughter that she'd raised to know her own mind and speak her own mind.
Yeah, she's defeated herself, but happily, happily. when I asked you the question about what made you such a questioner, you said it was about getting to the truth and uncovering things. You'd always been a questioner, but now that you've brought the whole theme of enthusiasm and curiosity in, I wonder if there's something of that too. Because I mean, you don't just interview people who is news. You know, you interview other people, cultural figures, and then I've always felt in those exchanges, what seems to come across is your enthusiasm for human lives, you know, for their details, and your curiosity about what everyone is thinking and doing. Is that also a motivation? Is that right? Have I got the right impression of that?
Well, I just hope people enjoy the interviews. I guess I've been doing it for so long that some stuff is the second nature to me. So I like to think that I do good interviews because that's I've been doing it so long and I'm good at it. And I'm genuinely curious about people. I mean, some of it is just, you know, if you read Sherlock Holmes and things, you know, part of the glamour of those detectives is the same as I think the glamour of being a journalist, which is finding out things about people, you know. And I remember once going to interview someone, it was about sporting injuries in rugby in particular. And it was, I tried to think, so I was a reporter at BBC then. And I was interviewing a former rugby player who had been left using a wheelchair as a result of a kind of scrum that had collapsed. And he was now a teacher at a private school, and we went there and I was waiting in the study for him, and I was looking at some stuff on his shelves and things. So when he came, you know, it was partly to put him at his ease because, you know, he's old style, you know, middle-aged, public school educated, headmaster at a boys school, and here's this Asian woman who's like, you know, 23 or so. I think it was at Newsnight, it was reported at Newsnight. I was 25 years old, and I said, oh, you're at Teddy Hall. I was at Teddy Hall too. Now the irony is we're both at the same Oxford College. He said, how did you know? And I said, there's a mug on your shelf. So sometimes it's just that level of detail. Just notice something like a photo or something in their room that's on display. I mean, you don't touch anything. You don't lift things, read them. But people put out all kinds of signs about themselves. And I think people are flattered if you take an interest. And
I thought it was
You interrupted me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bad interviewing.
I wasn't doing this because I am a private investigator and I'm trying to entrap people. I'm doing it because I love my job. And You genuinely want to find out what makes people tick and you want them to give you a good answer. And also, I'm really conscious that being on television in particular can be very uncomfortable for people. It's much more intrusive than even a radio microphone. So you want to put them at their ease and show them that you want them to be themselves. You know, you want them to be relaxed and give an interview that they're happy with. So all these things, you just want people to have a good time. And it always is a better interview as a result. And of course, the other big thing we haven't talked about, the biggest thing, for the girl who was the school SWAT, I always do my research. I do more research than anyone else. I always come fully prepared because you can't fake that stuff. And they always know if you know. And they love it. And people in general just love that you've bothered to prepare. It's about respect.
Yeah,
Andrew, it's not about me trying to trick them. I'm not trying to trick them.
No, I didn't say you're trying to trick them. No.
You're waiting for them to.
I think I've occasionally, you know, you've done a lot of interviewing of people for Humanist UK events. I think I've seen you trap someone once or twice. You know, I won't go into details, but I think every now and again you get someone. I think you seem to be able to get some people to say things they don't want to say. You know, things that they don't want to really admit to, whilst at the same time making them happy in a way that they are saying this. You know, they there's some things they don't want to admit or disclose, and you get it out of them, but they still like you at the end of it. They're still happy.
Oh, I found it who you might be thinking of. I never did this to you, did I, Andrew?
No, not to me, I'm happy to say. I've never opened up. No, but it's hard because sometimes, you know, people who, especially if they're in the public eye, right, they've got their public self. And yeah, they don't want to open up. But you managed to get past that.
It depends what they're coming on about. I mean, it's not my job to intrude on someone's private romantic life, for example, if it's not relevant. And I'm very conscious of the privacy of people just because they're famous, particularly in the showbiz world. You know, I don't necessarily want to go there. Actually, this is an interesting example. So I interviewed the director of Emancipation, which is this really remarkable Apple film starring Will Smith based on the true life of an escaped enslaved man at the time of the American Civil War. And it was, you know, the first film of his to come out since that slap at the Oscars. As it turned out, he'd actually, this was the last thing he'd been filming just before the Oscars. It's a remarkable film. I made the decision not to ask about the slap of the director because I just thought, you know, we've only got a 15-minute slot. And it's such a remarkable piece of work. And it just seems unfair. And it's interesting because, you know, we had a discussion about it and the next day. And some people said they think I should have asked one question. And I said, well, I'd had to not ask one of the others. And the only Black producer on Front Row, who's very, very experienced, I really respect, she agreed with me. And I just thought, you know, sometimes you have to trust your own instincts. But technically, you know, I could have asked about that. And, you know, with hindsight, I've had more time. Maybe there was something about the trauma of that film, which is a very disturbing subject, that might have had an impact on Will Smith.
Right.
But I still don't see how in a short interview with a man I've never met before and Will Smith not present, how I'm going to get an answer that could anyway be deemed to be genuinely psychologically insightful. I'm not a trained psychologist.
You had a podcast called How I Found My Voice, which where you interviewed people about, well, how they found their voice, how they became communicators, what it was in their lives and so on that did that. Why were you so interested in that aspect of people's experience? Is that a personal interest of yours? Is there anything in your own life, or are you interested just in that as a theme for others?
I mean, to be fair, the format came from Farah Jassat and Intelligence Squared. Farah Jassat is a wonderful producer who I'd worked with on Newsnight and Night Waves, which became Free Thinking at Radio 3. And what was good, though, because it was her idea to develop it quite as we did, but I think I helped pick a lot of the guests, and I realised what became fascinating for me was, in the same way that you and I have been talking about what is it as a child that feeds your passion, and then, you know, with luck, you grow up to draw on that and to do the thing you want. You often find that people who are successful, whether they're actors or politicians, they're motivated by something and they have been all their life. So, yeah, I interviewed John McDonald, who had been Shadow Chancellor, who, you know, did things like he and his first wife ran children's homes in the 70s when there were all kinds of scandals that emerged subsequently about children being exploited and abused in children's homes. I remember talking to a political correspondent about John McDonald. You know, he and his wife had the most amazing reputation for just being good people who did good, important things and, you know, genuinely cared. And, you know, so I'm just fascinated by something that a thread that runs through someone's life
right
from youth. And the same with kind of different kind of actors and performers and writers. You know, and also just great to know what, you know, everyone grew up in such different ways. You know, Elisha Pat growing up in Turkey and, you know, Richard Osman's really interesting upbringing as a child of a single parent. You know, one brother becomes a member of Suede, someone becomes this kind of amazing champion of British television. You know, I just, there's amazing stories.
So it's the richness of stories again. You just love it.
Interesting people. And they were, you know, people, you know, they had to be generous at the time to come on a podcast that they hadn't heard of. I mean, it did really well. And, you know, some of the episodes have kind of been picked up and quoted in the papers and things. But in a sense, people were being very generous with their time to come on. And you realise it's because they're generous people. In some cases, they knew my work. Well, they all knew my work. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it, I think. And it's just really nice, like, to have an hour in their company. You always learn something. That's the other thing. You know, I guess I'm hungry for knowledge and information. You always learn something new. Like last night, I have to tell you this. I was telling you before we started the recording, I've been introducing some films at the Science Fiction Film Festival at the Science Museum Group. I'm a huge science fiction fan. And we screened 2001, A Space Odyssey, special 70mm analog print. And I went early for my sound check because we were going to interview a NASA astronaut down the line as part of the live intro. And Matthew, the guy who runs the IMAX machines, he said, do you want to have a look? Oh my God. And I just, I'd never seen one before, but just, and he knew exactly what to tell me about how it works, how they thread it and how you keep them clean. And, you know, just seeing that equipment. And I, you know, it wasn't faking interest. Like, I genuinely was thrilled to be in an IMAX projection booth. So that's me. That's what I do. And I'm just everywhere I go. You know, I always tell people as a journalist, you know, you get to go into amazing places. Some of it is like, yes, you get to go into number 10, you know, or Tony Blair drives you from Oxford to London in his car when he's about to become prime minister. And you get to talk to him about politics for an hour on your own.
Right.
And sometimes it's much more simple stuff, like just sitting with, you know, a family in Iran who are not rich, but have let you into their lives to show you how they live, and they've invited you for Eid dinner, And it's a privilege to be in their home with them. I mean, these are all experiences I treasure, you know.
Asking questions, public service, the richness of stories, hard work and always learning. Samira Ahmed, thank you for telling us what you believe.
Thank you for having me.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.